If these walls could talk, well, if the walls of the Donegal District Lunatic Asylum and workhouses in the county back during the First World War could talk, they would paint the picture of a county suffering the fallout of the war. In this conversation, in partnership with the Donegal County Museum, myself, Michaela Clark, am joined by curator Judith McCarthy to uncover some of those tales. Some people sought refuge in workhouses during the war, while others, having physically fought in the field, sought a different sort of refuge in the asylum, which would later be known as St Connell's Hospital. The County Donegal Book of Honour, which was first published in 2002, holds the records of those who fought in the First World War. The stories of the men and women of the time are now being transported from behind the walls to a space where they are shared with listeners from near and far.
In the museum, we've been researching First World War and Donegal connections to First World War probably since about 2004. And at that stage, it was quite difficult to get information on men who had fought in the war. There was less available online, but also anytime we did an exhibition, people were reluctant to come forward with their stories. There was still a kind of stigma around men having fought in the First World War. But over time, that has changed dramatically. I mean, it's incredible in the last 20 years, the amount of work that has been done by ourselves, but also by a lot of other museums and institutions into sort of making people more comfortable with coming forward with those stories.
Looking at it from the outside in, you may wonder what the stigma with people sharing their experiences of the war would have been, but it was a very different society compared to today's world.
You've got to understand that the First World War took place between 1914 and 1918, and in the middle of that, you had the Easter Rising in 1916. So the men who went away to fight in the First World War, we were still part of the British Empire at the time. They thought they were going away to fight, you know, in protection of small nations like ourselves in Ireland. Some of them went away for idealistic reasons. Some of them went away because it was seen as possibly being exciting. They were young men. You know, they might have been working on a farm in West Donegal and they thought, well, this sounds like an exciting opportunity to go and see Europe and get paid to do it. So there were all sorts of reasons. In the middle of that period, the Easter Rising took place and Ireland started to look for its independence. And by the time they came back after the war, 1918, 1919, we were just entering into the period of the War of Independence. So they would have been seen as people who fought for the British. So when they came back, a lot of them were reviled. You know, they would have been looked upon as being nearly like traitors in many ways. And so they kept their stories quiet. They didn't talk about it. For that reason, but also because of the trauma they had experienced during the war. You will find that with any war, really. If you talk to veterans from the Second World War, Korean War, Vietnam War, they don't actually really want to talk about it because it was just so traumatic and they don't want to relive it. So there were those two reasons. They didn't talk about it because of the trauma, but they also couldn't talk about it because they would have been seen as being traitors because they had been fighting, seen to have been fighting for the British, although that's not why they would have enlisted in the first place. So that sort of concept passed down to their families. So their families then didn't talk about it and didn't want to admit that they had had someone in their family who had fought for the British, as it was seen in inverted commas, during the First World War. And that continued. That continued for decades.
The County Donegal Book of Honour contains much history in the form of the names of all those from the county who died during the First World War. It was published initially in 2002 and as a result of research has been added to over the years.
The initial research would have been done back in 2002, led by Paddy Hart Sr., who put a huge amount of work into researching all of the Donegal men and women, we have to remember as well. Who fought and died in the First World War. And that led to the publication of the first Book of Honour in Ireland. The first one was published here in Donegal. And that listed all the men by townland who had died in the First World War. And that was the sort of beginning of this kind of, you know, it's okay now to talk about them. It's okay that you can acknowledge that someone in your family, you know, was fought and died or fought in the First World War. For me, it's very interesting. One of the reasons I suppose I have such an interest in it is because in my own family, I have great uncles on both sides of my family who fought and died in the First World War. My mum, who is Irish, her uncle died in the war, but they didn't know anything about him. They only discovered that he was buried in Dublin in the late 90s, early 2000s. They didn't know anything because his story got lost.
And that's so traumatic.
My mum and her sister, who have both since have died themselves, went and visited his grave in Dublin. And it was just so emotional for them.
Yeah.
Yet on my dad's side, and my dad was English, his mother's brother died in the First World War. He was only 17 when he died. But they always talked about him.
Yeah.
They always talked about him. My dad knew about him and knew his story and knew they had his medals. And so that there was such a difference in those stories and that is replicated in households all over Ireland.
Yeah. And even what you talked about, I'm sure in England, everything's chronicled so much
Absolutely.
Compared to here.
Yeah, no. I mean, hugely different, hugely different. And that, for me, is very sad that those men and women who died in the war were forgotten about in many, many cases. So that's what we tried to do. We, in 2019, we updated the County Donegal Book of Honour. So we reissued the fifth edition with new research that we had done.
Work by the County Museum on the Book of Honour has led to the stories from behind the walls being uncovered. Judith traced records back to the Donegal Lunatic Asylum and the workhouses, which gives a deeper insight into what life for those who fought in the war was like and the help they would have sought.
In doing the research, I also uncovered stories of men who had survived, so the casualties. Particularly looking at some of the records that survive from the workhouses and from the Donegal District Lunatic Asylum. So I followed some of those stories as well.
Yeah, reading some of the information you give me, even the terminology used in that
oh, yes.
is so different. And it kind of gave the perception that these men, they were in the asylum and they were just left there. The language used reflects kind
yes.
of the time.
Yeah, yeah. No, very much so. Very much so. And also in doing the research, so you've got those men. There's even just some of the men that I found connected to the Book of Honour, some of the men who died and some of their stories. Because when I always say to people, it's like you disappear down a rabbit hole and you make connections and you find out things and you think, oh, I wonder where they were. I wonder what happened to and why is this piece of information missing? And that's when you start to uncover the different layers of their stories, that they're no longer just maybe a name, that there's more to it.
Yeah.
They had a wife, they had children, they had grandchildren. Those stories, the nature of archives and records, it's easier to find the men who died because a lot of them would be listed in the Commonwealth War Graves records. There are pension records available that you can view. And so you can make connections and see who their legatee was in their pension. Was it a wife? Was it a mother? And you can trace more information on them that way. If they survive the war, there sometimes is less information and it's harder to kind of find
yeah.
them. So that's why I would have gone looking in records such as the workhouse or the asylum records to find the men that survived. But the men who died, yeah, I mean, with the age now of digitization, so many records have been digitized.
Yeah.
So you can go onto, there are a lot of websites, UK-based websites, where you can find a lot of information and, you know, relatively easily.
It makes it more human.
Oh, no, absolutely.
You're able to connect with it more.
Absolutely. No, definitely, yes.
The Donegal District Lunatic Asylum was a place at the time where soldiers who served in World War One entered seeking help for what we would know today as post-traumatic stress disorder. But during those years, treatment would have been more or less non-existent. It was a stark contrast to the mental health supports available to those in need during the 21st century.
The asylum first opened in about the 1850s sometime, I think. A lot of the treatment was really just keeping people in the asylum and work and fresh air. They had large kind of gardens, and sometimes they would have people working in them. They had areas for people to sit outside. So they believed that exercise and fresh air could basically help with whatever was wrong with you. And there was very little in the way of kind of medical intervention in those early days. So they would have gone into the asylum for various reasons. Sometimes because that they were sent to the asylum. Sometimes they may have gone in voluntarily. Sometimes they came out. Some of them, and again, I can talk through a lot of the different records that I found. Some of them went in and out over decades.
Yeah.
Some of them went in and died in the asylum. I mean, it's very sad that that's what happened to them as a result of the war.
And they were so young.
Yeah, a lot of them were very young. I mean, a lot of them when they enlisted were, you know, 16, 17, 18. I mean, you had older men, of course, who had previous war experience, who might have fought in the Boer War in Africa. But so you had a real mix. A lot of them were young. A lot of them were very young, yeah.
So that physical representation that in their mind, particularly the asylum, they were trapped. They had PTSD.
Which wouldn't even have been known as PTSD at the time. I mean, shell shock wasn't even really diagnosed until sometime during the war. They called it neurasthenia at the time, which was basically shell shock, which is post-traumatic stress. But there was no recognition of that. This was the first time that they even considered that there might be something like that. And you'll see some of them with hallucinations. You'll see them with. And another thing that did happen, which was became prevalent during the First World War, was syphilis. Syphilis was a disease of the war. And that, if left untreated, can lead to insanity. So there are cases of that as well.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a real mixture, but all as a result of their service in the war.
Correspondence with a woman years on from the closure of the Donegal District Lunatic Asylum revealed the background of yet another man who died there. It then led to the uncovering of many more stories of those who had fought in the war but survived, but came back to Donegal to live out the rest of their life.
In the case of the records for St Connell's, which at the time was known as the Donegal District Lunatic Asylum, that was the name it was at the time. Those records are with the County Archives here in Lifford under the care of Dr. Neve Brennan. But they are very sensitive records, and they have access policies and with regard to who can look at the records. Because I was doing genuine research, I was allowed access. I don't reveal the names of any of the men who are in the asylum, and I've taken away any identify markers like their regiment number or anything that would be able to identify them, so that their kind of anonymity is protected. So how it all started in a strange way is that we received an email from a woman who had a few medals. I think it was her father who had worked in St. Connell's. And when they were doing some renovation work in there, you know, clearing away stuff, he had found some medals in a cupboard that nobody had ownership of or claimed ownership of. So he took them to look after them. And so they wanted them to come back to Donegal and to the museum because this is where they had originated from. And I was fascinated by who these medals might have belonged to, because with most of the medals from the First World War, they'll have the details around the edge of the medal, so you can find out about them. So I started to do some research, and that was my initial research. And one of those soldiers, we'll call him G.H., I discovered from looking at the pension ledgers online that he was resident in Sligo Jail. and he was discharged in 1920. So I thought, okay, right, we'll see if we can find the records of Sligo Jail online, which I did. And in that, he's born in Donegal of no fixed abode, and he's in Sligo Jail for causing an assault with intent to commit a felony. And he had been in Ballyshannon Court and had been sent to Sligo Jail. But it also said that he was subsequently transferred to Sligo Mental Home in 1923, from there to Mountjoy, and then to Dundrum, which is also, at the time, was a lunatic asylum. I then went looking for him in the records of the Donegal District Lunatic Asylum, and there he was, admitted in 1927 at age 29 from the what they call the criminal asylum in Dundrum. And he was admitted in 1927 and he died there in 1965. And although it says his form of mental disorder was due to congenital mental defect since epilepsy, more than likely, I think it was as a result possibly of an injury that he received during the war, during his service in the war. And of course, his medals had just, there was nobody to claim them. So his medals had just stayed in the hospital until they were rescued by this gentleman. The other man, who I'll call WD, he'd served in France, started serving in the First World War in 1915, came out what they call Class Z Army Reserve, which was when they were demobilized in 1918, they were posted to what was known as Class Z, which meant that they could return to service if needed, because they weren't sure that the war was fully over. But that was abolished in 1920. So we find him in the records of the asylum being admitted in 1926 with hallucinations. And he died in 1928 of what they called general paralysis of the insane, which was just a kind of catch-all phrase for, we don't really know what's wrong with him, but he's mad. And so, again, I mean, if he had hallucinations, again, the likelihood is, I mean, it was caused by the war. Yeah, so that kind of started me on my.
And it's so sad that it was the discovery of the medals, no records.
Just absolutely. That they obviously had those medals on them in their possession when they went into the asylum. They would have been taken from them and put in a cupboard or in a safe or something, and then discovered decades later. And I just started researching their stories, and it made me think there must be others. There has to be others in the records. So I went looking, and there they were, telling me their stories.
And so to many. Think that their stories wouldn't have been told.
No, I know. And that is, and that's what I mean about the people who survived. You know, I mean, we do, as I said, we've started to, in the last 20, 25 years, look at the stories of the men who died. But those that survived have kind of gotten lost a little bit. And I've just looked at the records of the Donegal District Lunatic Asylum. I mean, every county had an asylum.
Yeah.
So there are men.
When you think of Dublin, there was obviously a greater proportion.
Absolutely. So there were men in all of those. And their stories are yet still to be told. When I went looking, I mean, I found all sorts of men in there for all sorts of reasons. Often it lists the reason they're in there as the cause of them being there is the stress of campaign. That's what they called it, stress of campaign. They didn't know what else to call it. One soldier, LP, he was transferred from Belfast War Hospital. His place of residence was obviously Ballyshannon, but he ended up in the Donegal District Lunatic Asylum. He had enlisted in 1915. He was discharged in 1919. And what it says in these records called the Silver War Badge records, which were a Silver War Badge was awarded to soldiers who were injured in the First World War. And it says in those records that he was no longer physically fit for service. And so he was discharged. So he, as I said, went into the asylum in 1919 and he died in what was known as the mental hospital by then in 1941 at the age of 57.
And would their families have been made aware that they were in the asylum?
They probably were if they had families.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't.
I suppose they were very young.
They didn't always have families when they came back. So in some cases, absolutely, yes, I'm sure they would have been aware that that's where they were. But you either were put into the asylum by a doctor, or sometimes you could be put into the asylum by your family. And in order to get out of the asylum, you couldn't go out under your own steam. This was in those early days. You had to go out into the care of a family member, or someone had to be willing to look after you when you came out of the asylum. But in the case of someone who's clearly unwell, or who would have been perceived as being unwell, without them understanding that it was post-traumatic stress, would you have wanted your brother, your uncle, who's hallucinating, who clearly is unwell, to come home to you for you to try and look after them? You know, there wasn't that care in the community that there is now. Yeah. There was none of that.
No medication.
It was no.
Or
it was the asylum, or come home and what? This particular soldier, LP, he dies in 1941 of cardiac failure. He just dies of a heart attack. But he's been in the asylum since 1919. You know, and there's so many of them. Another one who I'll call RK. Again, hallucinations and stress of campaign. And his war medals, if you look, again, you can go into the records and see there's what they call the medal rolls index. His war medals were returned to the ministry.
Right.
Because he, at that stage, was probably already in the asylum. So whatever address they had for him, it went, and maybe nobody was there to accept the medals. So they were sent back. So he never received them. And again, he died in 1941. In the mental hospital from cancer.
And it's nearly, they fought in the war, but they fought this other battle.
No,
once
completely.
They've survived and
No, and I mean, and completely unrecognised as that they were fighting this battle. Mm. And, you know, probably, I mean, certainly by, I mean, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, treatment had changed. But I would imagine that at that stage they were just inpatients. They were patients of the asylum and...
They'd just been there
so long, and they were just one of many patients, and probably they weren't too much trouble and had maybe the odd kind of nightmares, waking in the middle of the night or hallucinating or...
And would the women have been in the asylum as well, or would they have been affected as badly?
Well, the problem with the women is that because the reason I can find the soldiers in the records, they're called soldiers.
Yeah.
In the case of women...
The rules were different.
Yes. So unless it says nurse, but I mean, what, you know, it's not going to say nurse who's fought in the First World War. You could have been a nurse anywhere. Much, much harder to track whether they ever ended up in the asylum. There's another gentleman here, TB. He was admitted in 1925 because of melancholia, delusion of annoyance... and injuries received in Germany, general neglect, 1 year. He was discharged again in 1925, but you find him in the records in 1926, 1928, and 1931. So he's in and out, each time delusions, violence, shell shock, bad treatment, i.e. as a prisoner of war, hardships while in Germany 12 months. So he'd obviously been a prisoner of war for 12 months. And as a result of that and of his service during the war, it impacted on his mental health. And he's in and out of the hospital, possibly because he had family.
Right.
And maybe while he was in there, he got better. As I said, in the 20s and 30s, there started to be some treatments. So maybe there was something, he was being treated. He got better, went back out again. And then within a period of time, it seems to be a 2 year period. He seems to be in and out. Do you ever watch Who Do You Think You Are? But what it does is it traces celebrities' family history. I was watching it last night and there was a comedian called Chris Ramsey on it. And he was tracing his grandfathers on both sides of his family. And they'd fought in the First World War and one of them had fought in the Second World War. Great grandfather and grandfather. But one of them had been a prisoner of war. In the First World War.
Right.
And what they said was, it wasn't like the Second World War where prisoners were treated badly. They weren't treated badly. But one of the problems was, is that if they were prisoners of war in Germany, they basically were starved because Germany was completely blockaded by the Allies.
Right.
There was very little food being produced, food going in and out, anything probably that was going to the soldiers, the German soldiers and the citizens. So prisoners of war were often the last people to be fed. So a lot of it was around that.
Yeah.
And so this gentleman, TB, had fought in the war and had then also been a prisoner of war. So he comes out, and as I said, he's in and out of the asylum. And eventually I found him having died in 1949 from what they call acute myocarditis, which my understanding is it's a heart disease, basically.
Right.
And again, it's not a stretch of the imagination to think that that was probably as a result of the treatment.
Mirrors.
Yes. And his treatment in the war and his treatment as a prisoner of war. That's the tip of the iceberg. We don't know. That's all we know from the records.
Yeah, we've no first-hand accounts.
No, and we've no idea what was going on in his home life, how this was impacting on his family. Was he able to hold down a job? It never says that he has a job. It just keeps calling him an ex-soldier.
Yeah.
So maybe he didn't have a job. So there's layers and layers of information there that we'll never know. And I think that's probably why I find it so fascinating, is to try and piece together their stories, to try and find out more about them so that we can talk
acknowledge
about them.
Exactly. And that they are victims of the war as well.
Yes, exactly.
What we know about those who fought in the First World War is remarkable from tracing records. Similar records tell the story also of sons, daughters, wives, mothers and fathers who bore the fallout of the war back home here in Donegal. These are the stories of the loved ones left behind.
Even the soldiers who died, there's some really kind of interesting stories that I found about them as well. For instance, there was a gentleman called Robert Macbeth Sheldon. And he had originally served in South Africa in the early 20th century and then enlisted again in the First World War. And I found him, he was killed in 1917, age 41, and he was fighting with the South African infantry. And when I went looking for him in the 1911 census, I found him living with his mother near a foe with a servant. They had a number of servants, because they often did on the larger farms, they had farm servants and they would list them in the census records. Mm-hmm. And he had a servant working with them called Ezekiel Smith. And it's an unusual enough name, Ezekiel in particular. And I rang a bell with me and I thought, hang on a second, there's an Ezekiel in the Book of Honour. I know there is. So I went looking for him and there was an Ezekiel Smith who was the son of Thomas and Mary Smith from Convoy. And he was killed in action on the 1st of July, 1916. So again, he also had a brother who was also killed on the 1st of July, 1916. So again, here's a family, Thomas and Mary, who've lost their two sons on the same day. Both remembered on the Thiepval Memorial. So again, no grave to visit. But it's not a stretch of the imagination to think that in 1911 and in the lead up to enlisting, Ezekiel is working in the home of a man who's a seasoned and veteran soldier, who fought in the Boer War, who's probably telling stories about it, probably making it sound a little bit more exciting than it was. He got to go to Africa.
Yeah.
They often made a lot of friends. There was a very strong sense of comradeship. And so Ezekiel, who was young, he's only 18, 19, 20, is hearing these stories. And so when his opportunity comes to enlist, he thinks, none of them did.
Yeah.
I mean, Robert wouldn't have understood what was facing them because it was completely different. The First World War, there had never been a war like it. I mean, that's why they took horses to the First World War, because they had been used, there had been cavalries in previous wars.
Yeah.
They thought, absolutely, we'll bring the horses. I'm sure the horses were of absolutely no use to them at all, except in dragging cannons, etc.
Yeah.
And hundreds and thousands of horses died during the war. But that was their concept at the beginning. They had no clue about how horrendous it was going to be. There's another gentleman, Braith, from St. Johnson, and he was killed in action again on the 1st of July. So many of them died at the Battle of the Somme. Just on the first day alone, Not to mention that the battle dragged on until November and thousands of men died. But I discovered subsequently that his sons, so you find him in the 1911 census, married to Elizabeth, and they have a daughter, Margaret. But they had two sons born subsequent to that, prior to the war. So Andrew born in 1912 and Thomas born in 1913. They both subsequently went on to enlist in the Second World War and to die in the Second World War. So Lance Corporal Andrew Galbraith died on the 24th of March and Sapper Thomas Galbraith died on the 6th of June 1944. Again, you can imagine that their father died fighting in a war.
He was a hero
He was a hero to them. Absolutely. And probably that's how they grew up, with these stories of their dad as a hero having died, killed in action on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And the Battle of the Somme was, you know, was something that was remembered in many communities in Ireland and in Donegal. And so, of course, when the Second World War came around, they thought, well, absolutely, we're going to follow in our dad's footsteps. And they both were killed. I mean, tragic. It's just tragic. It really is.
And it just shows you again that not much was known about the First World War, that this just repeated itself.
No, completely. Completely. We never learn our lessons. Another one that I found, and again, this connects to that idea of family as well and the families that were left behind, was a soldier called Patrick Murren. And he was the son of John and Anne Murren, and his wife was Cassie Murren, née Bradley. And I found him in the pension records, and his next of kin was his widow, Catherine, and he had a child called Annie Mary. But then in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records, his next of kin was his brother. And I thought, well, that's a bit strange. Why in one record is his next of kin his wife, mm-hmm. and in the other record his next of kin his brother? So I thought, oh, okay, right, I'm going to see what might have happened. So I went looking in the birth records, the death records. So Patrick and Catherine, Cassie she was known as, got married in April of 1914, so just before the war started. They had their little daughter, Anne Mary, on the 9th of January in 1915, and listed in the birth record, her father is with the British Expeditionary Force. So he's serving already at this stage. So then I wondered, well, as I said, why is it his brother who's listed as a next of kin? So I thought, okay, right, I'm going to look in the death records. I just have a bad feeling. So I found first that his daughter, who was 14 months old, died on the 13th of March 1916. And she's listed as the daughter of the late Pat Murren. So he's already dead at this stage. He died on the, well, he died on the 5th of April, but when her death was being registered, they already knew that he was dead.
Oh,
he was a member of the British Expeditionary Force. And she died of influenza and bronchitis. And then in February of 1917, Patrick's wife, Catherine, also known as Cassie, died. She was a widow at this stage, of course. She was a nurse. And she died of what they called pulmonary phthisis, which is a hard word to explain. That's TB, basically. So she had TB. And her sister was present at her death. So by February of 1917, Patrick, Catherine, and their daughter were all dead. You know, and I mean,
and that's
a whole family wiped out.
And that's a result of the war, just kind of filtering down.
Just filtering down. And I mean, it's absolutely horrific. He went off to fight in the war thinking he was leaving behind his wife and his daughter and they would be there when he came back. He died.
And he never met his daughter, did he?
She was
very young.
She was born in 1915. He was already serving. It's possible that he didn't.
Yeah.
It's possible that he didn't. I don't know, because it's very hard to see if they came. They would have come home on leave. So whether he came home on leave after she was born and before he died, I don't know. And that's why it's his brother who's the next of kin. It's because there's nobody else left. I mean, it's horrific. And that's probably not unusual either. Mm. Again, children, you know, mortality rates were very high at the time, both with children and with women. A lot of the time women died in childbirth. And in this instance, she got TB, but she was a nurse. So again, I wouldn't be surprised if she got ill as a result of her nursing experience. She wasn't nursing in the war, but at the same time, I wouldn't even be slightly surprised if that's what had happened to her. You know, I mean, it's just, again, it's just tragic.
Life for the soldiers' families was very difficult, and many availed of the services of the workhouse. These workhouses are much different to what we commonly envisage workhouses as during famine times. Instead, they offered work, meals, even medical treatment.
Even though the men were away fighting, the families would have received a small allowance for, you know, as the wife of a soldier. But they didn't have a man to work and support them. They were away. So in some cases, they ended up in and out of the workhouses. At this stage in the sort of early 20th century, the workhouses were nearly like a form of kind of early social care system. They also were the only form of medical care sometimes because they had infirmaries. What you'll find is you'll find people going into the workhouse sometimes at the beginning of the winter, the end of the kind of autumn, particularly if they were kind of seasonal workers, so they worked on farms. You'll find them going in like in November, coming out in the spring. So they're in there for the winter. Or they go in sometimes just for a week, a couple of weeks, back out again, maybe find work. Then that work stops, so they move on back into the workhouse. So that it was that kind of, it wasn't the workhouse of the famine times. Yeah. It was a different type of workhouse at that stage. That's where they were. They were behind the walls. They were behind the walls of the workhouse, or they were behind the walls of the asylum, and they were kind of lost a little bit in the records and in society.
The indoor relief register of the workhouse tells many tales of the time. The records in one case are that of a 23-year-old woman who was the wife of a serving soldier. She entered the workhouse on three occasions along with her two sons, who were aged 2 years and 8 months. Another record outlines how one soldier who was also 23 years of age spent 7 days in the workhouse.
When you go into the workhouse, it's a bit like an admission record, but they called them indoor relief because there was indoor relief and outdoor relief. I can't remember exactly the date when the outdoor relief was introduced. I think it was in the 1870s sometime, where they tried to, basically, to stop people going into the workhouse, they provided what was known as outdoor relief. And sometimes that was soup kitchens. And sometimes it was work as well. So they were paid to do work, you know, so that would keep them from entering the workhouse. So that was the difference then between outdoor and indoor relief. And so the indoor relief register is basically a list of people entering the workhouse. And so those records exist, again, in our county archives, which is based in Lifford, under the care of Neve Brennan, who's the archivist. So she has the original records. But actually, a lot of the workhouse records have been digitized, and they're available on findmypast.ie. And you can view them for free through the library service. Again, I have found records of people going into the workhouses. So Joseph Brogan, for instance, he was a soldier in the Royal Inniskillen Fusiliers, and I find him in the indoor relief register for Donegal Town. He was admitted on the 25th of April 1916 and discharged on the 8th of May. But in the what they call the indoor admission and discharge book, so they had lots of ways of keeping records. Mm. They like keeping records. Who's in, who's out? Because it was important to know how much money they were spending, because each person in the workhouse cost money to feed and clothe. So in the indoor admission and discharge book, there he is, Joseph Brogan. But they have him listed as aged/infirm. Now, he's not aged because he's 25. So clearly he was infirm. So probably as a result of an injury. So at this stage, he's already fighting in the war. He's probably just home on leave. And he goes into the workhouse. It's the only kind of form of any sort of medical assistance that you can get. So he probably went into the workhouse. He's there. He's only there for a couple of weeks. And unfortunately, as I said, he was discharged on the 8th of May. And then he appears in the County Donegal Book of Honour dead on the 16th of November 1916, which would have been during the Battle of the Somme. So he was probably discharged from the workhouse, finished his leave, went back to fighting, and then subsequently was killed in November of 1916 at age 26. And he's buried in Guillemont Road Cemetery in I think it's either France or Belgium. Unlikely again that his family ever would have, they wouldn't have visited his grave.
Then,
it's not not at all. Not at all. You didn't leave your parish, your county, never mind the country, to go and visit a grave. So, it's...
How difficult would it have been back then? Maybe I'm thinking more of the famine to get into the workhouses. Would it have been difficult?
No, not really. It was very different in the early 20th century. Much lower numbers of people using the workhouse system. At the time of the famine, the height of the famine, the workhouses were crowded, were overcrowded. As I said, a lot of times people coming and going in the workhouse system, a lot of elderly people, because we didn't have, there weren't community hospitals, county homes, anything like that. And also, as I said, because they had infirmaries, people who were ill, you'll get people with fevers, people with injuries going into the workhouse and into the infirmary system there and being cared for and then coming out again. So it was a different system than it was when the workhouses were first. I mean, it still wasn't pleasant, but was a lot different, and the diet was a lot better. And as I said, people were kind of using it in a way when they were elderly, because we didn't have anything else at the time. It was only with the introduction of the Free State that we started to, we started to have district hospitals, the county home in Stranorler, so there were other places then for people to go.
Lest we not forget the Donegal women who played their part in the war. Their names too are included in the Donegal Book of Honour. While maybe not physically fighting, they would have tirelessly cared for the soldiers, providing medical assistance, which in some cases would have ultimately led to their death.
Donegal women in the Book of Honour. There's nurses, two sisters, Anne and Mary Dixon, who were from Fawn. They both died as a result of their service in the war. One working, she was a nurse, and the other was a voluntary aid detachment. And often what happened with nurses is as they got ill as a result of looking after soldiers who were ill. Meningitis, diphtheria, pneumonia, Spanish flu, huge numbers of them dying as a result of that. Also, Florence Balfour, she was also a nurse, died as a result of, looking after men who are ill. And there's actually a memorial to her in a church in Dublin, Dundrum, from the St. John Ambulance Brigade, in loving memory of Florence Balfour Alford, VAD, who died on the 13th of January 1917, leaving a noble example of devotion to duty. And she died of measles, diphtheria and pneumonia. It's like, not just one thing, she got three horrible contagious diseases as a result of the work that she did. And she was only 28 when she died. And then you also had Margaret Watkinson. She was originally from Letterkenny and she was in the Royal Irish Service Corps. She died here in Lifford Hospital, actually, on the 31st of December 1919. And she was only 24.
Mm. And even for the women and the men heading off for their families, it must have been a terrible worrying time. They didn't know if they were coming home, or many of the bodies weren't recovered.
I think initially, there'd never been a war on this scale before. So if they enlisted in 14 or 15, a lot of them thought they'd be home by Christmas in 1914. Yeah. They assumed the war would be over. And as we all know, it lasted for four horrendous years. So as time wore on, they must have become more and more aware, as more men and sons and brothers in their communities died. And sometimes you didn't hear that. You might hear that they were missing, or you might not hear that they had died. It could be, weeks and months later that you've heard that they've died. And also, as you said, a lot of the time there was no body, there was no funeral, there was no grave to visit. They were either buried overseas or their bodies were never found and they're just remembered on memorials.
Yeah.
So there was a family called Charles and Mary Schooner from Remelton, and they lost three of their sons in the war. How horrendous could that have been? So between October 1916 and August 1917,
their three sons, James, John and William, all died in the war.
Like a full generation just...
No, that's like they had five children in the 1901 census, another daughter and a son, and three of them were dead within a year of each other. I mean, how would you ever recover from that as a mother or a father
yeah.
or a brother or a sister?
Do you think these stories would have been told, or it's kind of only you going through the records that it's the effort that somebody's making rather than...
Yeah, no, they're waiting. They're out there waiting to be told. So it's just about someone finding them. And I decided that I would do some research. And I'm sure there are people out there in other counties probably doing similar work. But, you know, they're out there. They're stories, you know, and we just need to look for them and find them.
And it's all our pasts.
No, absolutely. And I mean, these are just families. They're just young men and young women like ourselves who were living in a different time, but, you know, just trying to get by and ended up in a horrific, horrible, horrendous situation, fighting in Belgium, fighting at the Battle of the Somme, Passchendaele, Ypres, fighting in Gallipoli and the horrific conditions in Gallipoli, fighting in the sea, died at sea, bodies never found. And remembered on memorials like the Plymouth Naval Memorial in England, far, far away yeah. from home.
We have only scratched the surface of the untold stories of the First World War from behind the walls. As Judith said, there are many more stories waiting to be told. The records of the Donegal Book of Honour, the Donegal District Lunatic Asylum and the Workhouse give us just a snapshot of their lives and the trials and tribulations they endured. You can listen back to this episode and other instalments on our website highlandradio.com. Tune in next Wednesday when I will be joined by Donegal archivist Niamh Brennan to delve into Donegal claims and compensation from the Irish Grant Committee and how such records piece together stories of the county's past. This podcast series was funded by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sports and Media under the Community Strand of the 2023 Decade of Centenaries programme as part of the Decade of Centenaries Initiative 2012 to 2023.